Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Podcast. I am Sir Matt.
And I'm Sir Jimmy of House Nuts. Welcome back to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into Catelyn IV of A Storm of Swords, my favorite book of all time, from probably my favorite POV of a mother of all time. I guess Cersei would have to be up there as well. What chapters do you prefer, Matt? Do you prefer Cersei or Catelyn as a mom, specifically as a mom?
Probably Cersei.
You think?
Yeah. I don't know. Catelyn, I have a hard time with Catelyn chapters, but there's some interesting things in here, but I think it's just because Catelyn seems to make blunders, right? And you're always like, God, I wish she was doing something else instead of everything she is actually doing in her chapters. Whereas Cersei, I'm always just intrigued reading it because we get her story so late and we feel like we've been given a specific side of her. So by the time you get to her, just like with the Jaime chapters, by the time you get to the Cersei chapters, you're like, I'm so intrigued as to see what's going on in her mental state. However, the Catelyn chapters, knowing what we know now, of course, that she becomes Lady Stoneheart and all of that stuff, that's, I think, the really cool, interesting part is the foreshadowing. And there's something in here today, actually, I will say, was something I haven't really thought about in quite some time about jumping way ahead when she is Lady Stoneheart. And we will come back to that because I found that to be, I was like, wow, that actually is, man, quite interesting. So yeah, keep your Lady Stoneheart frame of mind in for today's chapter. But Jimmy, there's some like big news dropped before we even started.
I think it is. Is it big news?
I'd say so.
I mean, in this grand scheme of things, I feel like it's like mid to big.
Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty cool. Anyway,
we got some
new step photos from Duncan Egg. George went over there and he seemed to be having a good time, which is great because he's been not having a good time with HBO, right? As of late. And Jimmy and I just did a Patreon episode breaking down, you know, what he said last time about some of the spoilers he dropped for season 3 and season 4, where we went through with new information from George himself. We broke down our outline, which we've been talking about doing for a while, but
which is full spoilers, by the way, for all of House.
Completely full spoilers. And Joker as well. We did dump on the Joker movie a little bit just to talk about, you know, people having issues with Warner Brothers and just letting people do whatever they want.
And so, then losing millions of dollars constantly.
And how that's probably going to, that might affect season 4 too. So anyway, here we go. George has a big thing and there's some cool photos of the Duncan Egg show. So we'll get to talk about that a little bit. So he's been traveling, right? So he says, after Belfast, the next stop on our summer travels was Ashford Meadows, where I'd heard there was a tournament going on. No way I was going to miss that. So off we went. Rumor was that some Targaryen princeling would be attending. Yes, I'm talking about the newest Game of Thrones spinoff show. It's an adaptation of The Hedge Knight, the first of my Duncan Egg stories. There will be two more after that, The Sworn Sword and The Mystery Knight. They've all been collected in a book called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It's probably going to be in the title of the show as well, unless we go with The Hedge Knight. That's still under discussion.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they're still, I mean, it's coming up, so we sort of thought that it was going to be The Hedge Knight was going to be the name of it. We'll have to see. Filming wrapped not that long ago, and Ira Parker and his team are now in post-production, looking forward to a debut sometime next year. Spring, I am hoping, but that's just a guess. No date has been set yet. Interesting. I thought we were all told like early, but maybe not. So anyway, he goes into it a little bit more and all of these things, talks a little bit about what it is and, you know, sign up kind of some cool things. And we can come back to that, but let's take a look at some of the photos, I think is what people really want. So the tourney grounds, one of the first things he saw, 3 days I visited, they were gray and rainy, mud everywhere, but the lists were so real, just a right place for Ashford, far from the big cities and great seats of power. It's not actually too far from Harrenhal. It's on the lake, right? Which mm-hmm. is what we've been talking about with all of the stuff in season 2 of House of the Dragon. Could be interesting that Ashford Meadow sits right there on the same lake as the God's Eye and Harrenhal, and maybe we'll even see that. So kind of a cool little tourney ground here. And there he is.
Dunk the Lunk. For those who are the audio listeners, as most of you are, you can go check these out on GURMS, not a blog, but we can just tell you from looking at them, they look fantastic.
It looks so good. Yeah. Yes. What's that shield he's rocking, though? You know, I mean,
I assume one he picked up from the merchant that he needed, or one that he picked up whenever he was with Arlen. I'm not sure, but it is definitely going to get tied back to Brienne of Tarth at some point, right?
Yeah. And yeah, eventually, he should get that shield. We'll get a different painted shield. Here we go to. You can see somebody being bullied there. You can't really make out the sigil on this person, but Dunk is obviously standing there looking at this whole thing go down. Is that an apple? Oh, no, that is. Oh, there we go. Yeah, that's the Fossaway. It's an apple. It's just kind of hard with the lines and everything. Okay, so that's pretty cool. So, all right, we know that from the story. And then there's just another photo of George and Peter Claffey, right? The actor who plays Dunk.
He looks great, by the way.
He looks great. I think.
I was a little, remember I said, I wish he was a little like rough around the edges, maybe longer hair, but I got to tell you, I'm starting to believe that he's Dunk.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And here we have our Tanzel Tootall, which you said, actually, man, she doesn't really look that tall, but I think we looked her height up and I think she is.
Also, tall's relative, right? How tall is everyone else in the show? They can do some miracle things. I mean, Tom Cruise is like 4'2", and they make him look 6 foot in action movies. So
yeah, I mean, apparently, he was Jack Reacher. So, I mean, but then you look at Alan Richardson playing, and you're like, they could not be further from the thing. Yeah. But, here we go. And we got some statues, right? We know we're going to get Danzel's dragon puppet, he says. Can't wait to see that in live action. Yeah, so
big nose right there, though. That last sentence, scroll down just a little bit. It says, the various Targaryen princelings were not working on the days we were visiting, but I saw some scenes with the Laughing Storm played by Daniel Ings, and he was outrageous and fun and Baratheon through and through. And for me, that's all I care about.
Yep. Yeah, he said, Ashford was one of the highlights of our travels. And a few weeks after I got back home, I saw a rough cut of the first episode. I loved it. I can't wait to see more.
Yeah, so George seems to be happy with this show while he despises Ryan Condell and wishes bad things upon him constantly. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I'm kind of kidding. So that is interesting, right?
He said he liked House of the Dragon, too. So now I'm like, oh, I don't know. Sooner or later, they might just do something.
They're going to end up writing out a minor character's name from something, and he'll be upset about that. But I'm hopeful. I think it looks really cool, and I'm very, very excited about this. He also, in a blog post right before this, not really much to go over. He was just kind of highlighting the Game of Thrones studio tour out in Belfast. I was just in Ireland. I did not do the studio tour. I elected to do the more like walking film location one, but I am going to be going back to Ireland next year, and I'll be doing the studio tour as well. And also one of the D&Ds, I can't remember which, had also recently been to the studio tour, and it looks incredible. As well as there's some other Game of Thrones TV news. So our friend Gray Area, another Song of Ice and Fire content creator, was advertising for this, I believe, but they are now auctioning off original properties from the TV show. And in case you were like, oh my gosh, I'm going to go bet on stuff, don't worry about it. You don't need to, because everything's going for like $10,000 to $20,000 to $30,000 to $40,000. So I was actually bidding in this. They had the tournament scroll that Robert Baratheon had in the first season, and I wanted to get it so I could frame it as part of my Bobby B collection. And I said, you know what? I'll splurge. I'll go $500 on this. It's a one of one, you know, wow, I'll do it. And Matt, guess how much it sold for?
How much?
You were $5,000.
Whoa.
That's what I said. And I'm just like, who's buying this? Like, who can afford this? This is insane. Now I get it. The Hound's Helm, I think, was $30,000, $40,000. I get that. That's one of those iconic things in the show, right? Or like Jon Snow's doublet, of course. Mm-hmm. But a scroll that was in a second of an episode for Robert Baratheon? Thousands of dollars.
Let's pull this up. So this is like this is it, right? It's Heritage Auctions. They're selling it.
Yeah, it's a very serious auction site. I had to like verify my identity. I had to give them a DNA sample. But I mean, you can buy Loras Tyrell's full armor suit and the current bid.
Let's look at some of it. Well, you might Peter Dinklage's doublet from Game of Thrones. Wow, that's pretty sweet.
1400, but it just went to a live bid. So these, I've seen the live bids going. Most of the stuff is going for over $10,000.
I mean, this is Ned Stark's outfit.
Literally what
Sean Bean wore. $8,000.
Yeah, we're not talking about replicas. You can go get those on ValyrianSteel.com or whatever they call themselves now. Though I've had bad experiences with them, unfortunately.
Maybe I should buy the Mountain's two-handed sword that, you know, he can wield with one hand because Hathor Bjorgson is a freaking absolute quite literally giant of a man, and
but you can get his doublet,
sword. You could work out with it, Jimmy.
Yeah, you can buy the dragon skulls that were in the show. Starting bid $4,100.
Well, I mean,
if only I was rich.
We better start cranking out some Patreon episodes.
Look at Cersei's dress ensemble. Wow. $10,000. Hold on.
You could buy the actual dragon egg from season one.
Daenerys. How much is that, Matt? How much is that current bid?
$21,000.
Who's, and these items are selling, by the way. They're not just listing, and people are buying this.
Maybe there's something cheap here. We could
can we community pool our audience to buy us like a pot?
Ooh, I mean, here we go. This is the actual scroll that Ned Stark, you know, summoned for Tywin Lannister. Man.
I mean, super cool stuff, though. Like, I'm a little annoyed by the pricing because I just want to know who in the hell is buying all this stuff. But, I mean, how cool is it that the props literally have, like, the words written on them? Like, it's not an empty piece of paper. Like, they're actually written.
I mean, here's Needle.
Yeah.
Needle. I mean, the actual Needle from the show, $9,200. Wow, this is cool, man. This is, you know.
Cool until you realize that. None of us can afford any of it. I'm a collector, dude.
Here's another dragon egg that's 14. Wow, there's a ton. There's pages and pages.
There's 72 pages, but they've also sold about 75 pages worth as well.
So some of this stuff has already been sold. So
no, all this is still live. I'm saying that there was already more stuff being sold. You can buy the Iron Throne.
Here we go. Price. Let's search by price highest. Long Claw is more expensive than the actual. It's one of the Iron Thrones. That's the touring Iron Throne.
To be clear, though, this is the starting bid that has not actually went to auction yet.
$40,000. Wow.
That will go over $100,000.
Here you go, Jimmy. Here's the one you need to buy. Time left one day. It's about to go live. The dagger. Now, I guess that's interesting because you would think that they'd be using the same prop.
Well, I guess they refine it and stuff. So I have a replica Catspaw dagger. Actually, so I'll just tell this story. So ValyrianSteel.com makes replica Game of Thrones stuff. I'm a big fan. I have Needle, Longclaw, Oathbreaker, and Ice from them. I loved everything they've done. Then at the end of season 8, I got the Catspaw dagger, and it says Arya Stark on it, like engraved. So I got it, and they misspelled Arya's. It says Ares. And I messaged them, and I said, you know, I paid way too much money for this. Like, this is a significant defect. And you know what they told me, Matt? They'd give me 5% off on my next order. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm a part of a podcast and I have a YouTube channel. Whoa. I will make sure to tell people not to go to your website anymore.
Wow. Okay, then.
So I do not recommend ValyrianSteel.com. I'm still salty about that years later.
Okay. I mean, I'm looking at this stuff, and this is pretty crazy. So a thought comes to mind. One, some of these things, there's multiple versions of it, probably because they had multiple props and things like that, too. So, you know, this is probably the long claw. This is the touring Iron Throne. I would imagine, and just like this, you know, it says Arya Stark, Catspaw Dagger. And so if there's multiple, I would imagine there's multiple versions of it, because when you click on it, some of them actually say like, well, this is the one that was used specifically in like season 7. I would imagine that the one that they're using in season 8 is probably the same one they're using in House of the Dragon. Because some of those things,
I don't know, man.
Some of those props stay over and they use, and they'll like, because they want to use the same prop from things there is, to keep it authentic.
Is there something sort of melancholy to you about all this stuff being sold?
No, considering how much money Joker costs Warner Brothers, they probably have to sell it to be able to fund the next season of House of Dragon.
Well, I think
that's probably why they're selling it. Like, we need cash. Like, we're in trouble. Sell it all.
You might be right, honestly. Yeah. Hey, maybe they shouldn't have cut House of the Dragon season 2's budget, and they should have just not made Joker 2.
Seriously. I mean, that, yeah,
I know that's not how that works, but I'm just going to be bitter.
I know it's not, but is there any one prop? I mean, we talked about this, I think, last time or a while ago, is there any one prop that you'd want?
I mean, I would really love to have Robert's crown or Warhammer. I think that would be pretty excellent. I also wouldn't mind having like Bran's wheelchair just to wheel around in for a little bit. What?
That's the Dran's wheelchair. There's Renly's crown. That's kind of
cool. It's sick. Yeah. So I mean, if you guys want to go dream with us, because we can't afford any of this stuff, you guys should go check it out. I mean, it's crazy just how much work went into this show. I mean, we know that, but when you go and see all these props and I mean, literally probably thousands at this point.
Yeah.
Somebody sat down and made all that in very, very intimate detail, and it just goes to show that, you know, the show was special all the way down to the threads that were put into the clothes. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, pretty cool. Dang. Okay.
Yeah, man.
Well, with that, Jimmy, let's move over to today's chapter. This one's a big one.
It's a big
chapter. A lot goes down here. So this is Catelyn 4 of A Storm of Swords. Hoster Tully has finally passed away, and his family and bannermen are gathered for the funeral.
Finally. The old bag's dead. Like, well, geez, Matt.
You guys just hanging around.
Jeez, Matt.
So Lame, Lothar Frey, and Walter Rivers have come to Riverrun to negotiate a meeting between Rob and Lord Walter Frey that will hopefully restore the alliance. The Lord of Riverrun is placed on a funeral pyre boat launched by Rob, Titus Blackwood, Janus Bracken, Jason Malister, Mark Piper, Carl Vance, and Lothar Frey. Lothar is invited to take the place that would be Desmond Grell's as a gesture of goodwill toward House Frey, as an effort from Rob to apologize for his failure to keep his vow of marrying a Frey. Edmure tries to launch an arrow at the ship to light it, but he misses 3 times. He gives the bow to Brandon Tully, who hits the boat, causing it to catch fire. Later, Rob is devastated by the news from Duskendale, shocked that Robert Glover and Helmand Tallheart took it upon themselves to attack such an insignificant castle, losing nearly a third of Rob's infantry. He later states his intention to exchange Robert for their captive Martin Lannister. The king tells Catelyn of Sansa's marriage to the imp. Catelyn begs him to bend the knee and make peace with the Lannisters, but Rob will not hear it. At dinner, Lothar tells them that his father received word from Little Walder and Big Walder at the Dreadfort that Winterfell has been burned and Roderick Cassel killed. Lothar remarks that the Bastard of Bolton rescued the survivors from Winterfell to Catelyn's disbelief. Lothar brings his father's terms that Rob appear in person to offer apology and Edmure marry Rosalind Frey immediately. Rob dismisses Lothar and Bastard Walder, and when Edmure balks at not being able to choose his wife, the Blackfish reminds him that he must make amends for his blunder with the Battle of the Fords.
Yeah, so big chapter, a lot of maneuvering, obviously a huge death whenever Hoster Tully goes down. But I love this chapter because we get the Blackfish and we get the Edmure. I think the Tullys are very underrated. I always put them lower in my tier rankings for family, but not because I think that they suck or anything, but it's just because we don't get quite enough of them, in my opinion. I think we could use more Edmure and more Brendan. But this chapter is pretty great. And I know earlier you kind of mentioned that Catelyn makes a lot of blunders, and I would agree with you. But in these chapters, Catelyn is actually internally a voice of reason and what she wished Rob would do. Oh, he's playing the boy, not the king, right? Like that's a pretty big line that she says. So outside of some of her own biases, Catelyn does have some really good advice or thoughts. but she maintains her position as you know, a mother, and it also someone who's in a very negative light from freeing Jaime Lannister. She's actually not speaking up maybe as much as she should. Maybe she should be giving more advice. And at one point in the chapter even says, maybe we should sow for peace and bend the knee, to which Rob, and this is where he's playing the boy, says never, like literally, I will never do that. So Catelyn, though she does make many blunders, she's also extremely rude to Jon Snow, which no one likes. She does have some good ideas and thoughts and decisions, but she can't force Rob to make them. I think that she sees with a more clear eye for her son than she does herself. And I think that that is part of like the motherly nature that George writes into the character. That's so very good.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. This is probably one of the better Catelyn chapters, at least for her, where she's actually
voice of reason. Yeah.
Right. A voice of reason, because she's seeing Rob slip up. Right.
Yeah. Rob's, I mean,
Rob's making mistakes and sort of trying to fix it. And there's one point where she's going to slap him, and yeah, she's like, but at the same time, she's like, I'm sure he feels all alone. So she's actually even showing, you know, some emotion there to see, you know, why yes, he's making the decisions he is. And there's like the mother part of her that comes out instead of the, you know, politician and trying to help her.
Right. What resonated with me in this chapter is how melancholy this is, and how the Starks are just continuously losing and bad, you know, more bad news coming in. Winterfell has been burned to the ground. Like, I really felt the despair in this chapter, and the way that Catelyn, like the way George writes Catelyn to voice these things inside of her head are really, really, really impactful to me. So I could just feel things slipping more than maybe ever before. In any of my other rereads, you kind of get that foreboding sense, not just with all the foreshadowing of the Red Wedding, which there's even more here. Like, it's obvious the Freys are up to something, but just that the war is slipping from them. They're fighting from both sides. The Greyjoys have screwed them over in many ways. Rob has made decisions that have kind of separated his bannermen. His mom obviously is a traitor in many people's eyes. And I always thought of, like, you know, the Red Wedding when I read through these multiple times, I'm always thinking, man, the Starks were so close to winning. But I think you can tell, especially in this chapter, that that is not the truth, and that they had started to lose this battle long ago. And by the way, in this chapter, we get more proof that the Boltons and the Freys are in bed with one another. That's very subtle, but like the Boltons being praised as this like positive thing, and Walder and Walder up at Winterfell. Like, it's so obvious that there's deceit going on in the North. And the Boltons, I mean, there's full misinformation about the Boltons, right? They're doing
good things. And somebody even says, and I'm trying to find the exact line where he's talking about, like, well, in war, it's hard to tell. You know?
Like, yeah, yeah, like, right? It's like, information is so slippery in Westeros because of the manner of which they communicate, which is birds and letters that can be manipulated, and how fast do these letters travel? I mean, they are not getting instant information. Me and Matt grew up in a time where that was also true for us. You know, where a home telephone was a miracle. But now with the age of the internet and cell phones and everything, everything's so instantaneous. People forget that back in the day, bad news used to take a little while to get around.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did.
Certainly does in Westeros.
Yes, it did. Yeah. I was trying to find that line, but yeah, so there's a lot going on in this chapter. So I think we'll kind of do some big takeaways here. Mm-hmm. But the one I kind of want to start with, Jimmy, is maybe perhaps a little bit of like ultra theorizing a little bit ahead.
Okay.
So the conversation that they have about Tyrion and, Sansa has been married, and they talk a little bit about oath breaking, right? Mm-hmm. And so it says he swore to trade her for his brother. She said dumbly, Sansa and Arya both. We would have them back if we returned his precious Jaime. He swore it before the whole court. How could he marry her after saying that in sight of gods and men? He is the Kingslayer brother. Oath breaking runs in their blood. Rob's fingers brushed the pommel of his sword. If I could, I'd take off his ugly head. Sansa would be a widow then and free. There's no other way that I can see. They made her speak the vows before a septon and don a crimson cloak. So, kind of interesting. I think often because it seems like we're about to see it, is Jaime with with running into Lady Stoneheart.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it kind of be more interesting if we got a Tyrion? Because we don't know how Lady Stoneheart's going to die or the role she's going to play.
Oh, yeah.
But couldn't that be an interesting thing, because that's really what starts Catelyn's whole story off. I mean, Bran gets attacked, you know, and that's, you know, there's, you know, with the cat's paw dagger and stuff like that. But I mean, that is the first thing that really kicks it off. But I mean, the thing that really kind of throws all of this, into play. I mean, the trigger that actually like is like the first official act,
the big blunder,
send the entire Game of Thrones, at least in terms of what's going on in Westeros with the War of Five Kings and everything, into play, is Catelyn taking Tyrion.
Yes, and you mentioned blunders earlier, and I think we all can, and with 2020 vision on hindsight, of course, we can say, yeah, not a great move by old Catelyn Tully. not the best, but it would be interesting to see Tyrion and Lady Stoneheart come back together, you know, almost like, you know, she met Tyrion, then Jaime, then now she's meeting Jaime again, and like we're almost going in and out, you know, first in, last out kind of deal. Like maybe the last thing she sees is Tyrion. I don't know. One of the things that kind of struck me about maybe prophetic nature of the writing that George has is like, so we see Edmure in a very comedic scene. Edmure cannot hit the boat with the flaming arrow. Brendan's like, it's fine. Don't worry about it. You're okay. It just happens. Do you think that Lady Stoneheart will be ended with a flaming arrow as is custom for the Tullys?
It could be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Stoneheart to me is, God,
what a wild card.
I mean, seriously, it could just go in so many different directions. I've still always kind of thought the idea of like her seeing Arya or Sansa, and it's almost like she's like a, you know, like a, you think like a ghost who's lingering on for a purpose, and then it finally sees that they're alive, and then that sort of purpose is fulfilled.
Or maybe, you know, she was given breath to come back to life from Beric Dondarrion. Maybe she gives her breath to revive one of her daughters.
Like an Arya or Sansa dies. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Speaking of Beric Dondarrion, I just wanted to shout out. I think someone had a comment on one of our videos or someone messaged me. I can't remember. But they were saying how there is actually a like a masked man in Winterfell. And I did not look into it enough, so I can't speak to it. But they were saying that once we get into the
ghost of Winterfell, that
not the ghost of Winterfell necessarily,
the one like, that, because there's the one that people don't know, some people think it's Theon.
Yeah, so someone was speculating that Beric Dondarrion is gonna save Jaime in Winterfell as Arya, because we had that line last week about Jaime thinking Beric Dondarrion was attractive. And I was like, damn, maybe that's where Beric Dondarrion went. Now I'm gonna be honest, I think Beric Dondarrion is dead. I think he has served his purpose. So I think that that's probably good enough at this point. But I don't know. I am very curious, you know, what could come of it. But Lady Stoneheart, without a doubt, biggest mystery wild card. George said she's so consequential to the story that it was a huge miss for the show to leave her out. We know that he feels that way about everything that's left out, no matter how actually impactful they are. But I do think that Lady Stoneheart, has a significant role to play. And for some reason, I feel like it's going to be with Arya. And I don't know why that is, but I feel like it'll be Arya. Maybe it's, hey, what about this? What if it is a meeting with Jon Snow where she writes that wrong? I don't know. Also, how capable is she of even doing these things? Because when we see her, she is not in a state where it's Catelyn Tully.
Jimmy, let me tell you a story. You remember last year I went to Italy, and on my trip to Italy, I accidentally got stuck in Spain. The flight I was going through got delayed in England, and I had to go to Madrid for a night. And let me tell you, as someone who doesn't speak Spanish, that was very difficult. Thankfully, my wife does, but I think it's probably high time that I learn some Spanish, because you literally never know when you may need it.
And there's only one option if you're going to be learning a foreign language, and that is Rosetta Stone. As the world's most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app, it truly immerses you in the language that you would like to learn.
Rosetta Stone is a trusted expert for nearly 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and more.
And we're talking about fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. I mean, for one, no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and most importantly, think in that language. It's an intuitive process that helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, and of course to sentences. It's designed for long-term retention.
And they've got speech recognition, a built-in true accent feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent.
And we're talking about how convenient this app is all the time. Flexible learning, anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with mobile app or on your desktop on your own schedule.
And it's an amazing value. They have a lifetime membership that has all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages you need in life. That's lifetime access to all 25 courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off. I mean, that's a steal. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Bend the Knee listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
I mean, Catelyn, sorry, it's not. It's something different. And yeah.
I mean, she's the most interesting resurrection of all of them, to be honest, because she's like a very different person if you look at the resurrections, even if you take the show into consideration, like resurrected John is still kind of the same person. He's definitely a little bit there. I mean,
that will be better,
older,
I feel,
but I think, you know, it's just because he's a little bit older and he's like King of the North. And dealing
with Danny. In the book, George will explore the price of resurrection because it's literally one of his roles. He talks at length about how resurrection should cost a price and it should not be the same thing. It's one of his problems with Tolkien's works that he talks about. I shouldn't say problem. It's one of the things he wanted to commentate on whenever he wrote A Song of Ice and Fire. So John is 100% going to be affected by his resurrection, whereas in the show, let's be just quite honest, he wasn't. He wasn't at all. Now, that is a weird thing that you bring up, though, Matt, that Catelyn and John will both have been resurrected.
Yeah.
That's another link between them.
That could be an interesting play. To see. It's why, I mean, she's so, you're, as you said, and George said too, consequential to the story. I mean, because she is the ultra wild card. Even more so if you look at the characters that they missed out on in, or the characters who there's a few. So if you look at the characters, one who the show kept out and the show sort of went in a different direction with than what George is likely to do in Winds of Winter. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the three biggest pieces in Winds of Winter that are obviously different than the show is Stannis, Lady Stoneheart, and Young Griff. Young Griff and Lady Stoneheart are not even in the show, but yeah. Stannis may be totally different than
plans have changed too. Let's be honest. I mean, George has said, he's like, turns out things have changed.
Yeah, I mean, he said it multiple times. We've talked about Stannis. It's like, if he survives, we've been talking about for years. I mean, if he survives the battle against the Boltons, then he could become an enemy. There's so many different things you could do with him, and because it just seems so unlikely that he would die given his character. But you do still have the pink letter out there that you're going to have to deal with even if Stannis goes in the same direction the other things go in the same direction as well. Like you get the Battle of the Bastards. Of course, there's different circumstances because it's not Sansa and all of those things. Maybe it's just Sansa and Young Griff go up there and they help Jon. And now it's actually Sansa and Young Griff, as opposed to like John and Danny, like it was in the show.
There's many combinations that we could do with Young Griff.
Sure, certainly. The other problem you still have is Lady Stoneheart. Like, regardless of what happens with those of the two big pieces, she's a wild card out there and a force to be reckoned with as she's going around doing all of these things. Unless she dies early, which doesn't seem to be the case, she is going to be the one thing that throws all of this stuff into like totally different territory than show. I agree with George that she is probably the one character who should have been capped.
Yeah, but she wasn't appealing to quote unquote soccer moms and basketball players. That's what they said, unfortunately. So two notes, and then if we want, we can move on. But these are two notes about Lady Stoneheart I really wanted to bring up. One, I saw a theory and I thought this was insane. I don't know how we do this, by the way. Like, I just don't see it happening. But listen to this one. What if I was talking about Lady Stoneheart passing on her breath? I just remembered that I want to bring this up. There is a theory that John stays dead all of the Winds of Winter, and the end of Winds of Winter is him coming back. And we get interlude, like chapters, epilogue, prologue, maybe from his perspective, warged into his wolf, right? Ghost. Lady Stoneheart ends up at the wall thinking Arya's there. It's Jane, right? And then she ends up giving her life and her breath to Jon Snow to resurrect him. And then this big arc. Now, here's the second thing I could see her doing, and this would be satisfying as all get out. And this is what the show should have done, because you know as well as I that they didn't know what to do with this character. Peter Baelish.
Yeah.
Lady Stoneheart is the end of Peter Baelish.
Yeah.
Because he turned his back on her. He has ruined her family. He turned his back on Ned Stark. He killed Lysa, right?
Yeah, because to me,
Captured Sansa.
His death in the show was the first time, because a lot of people were like, well, I saw cracks in season six and stuff.
Sure,
like that.
Whatever.
I loved season six. Season seven was the first time that I was like, man, something's off here. And it was when it's those first few episodes of season seven where before they kill Baelish, and it's Sansa and Arya. And it just felt like they just didn't know what to do. And then his death to me literally just feels like, I know that they sort of built it up. They had a little bit of build up there where he's like trying to, you know, play both sides and everything. But it felt that to me is might even be the most rushed thing in all of Game of Thrones, the show. Because he's such a huge consequential character. And I've always thought him and Varys are going to have some big back and forth thing, you know, and then that didn't sort of happen the way we thought it was going to.
The promise of his character never became fulfilled. They had followed George's blueprint to a certain degree, and then, you know, then they went on their own manner or whatever. And it wasn't satisfying. It's not a satisfying end, other than the fact that he does get his comeuppance. Like, that's cool, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not enough for what we were promised with Baelish as a character. But then you add in Lady Stoneheart, who has plenty of reasons to have issues with Baelish. And for him to be undercut by the woman that he fell in love with so many years, I mean, you know, that's a great story. So it's more likely that happens than somehow her ending up at the wall, seeing Bran maybe coming back from the three-eyed Raven. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff at the wall that would be cool. I just don't think it's nearly as likely as maybe her being involved in Baelish. Plus, she's in that area already. Right. Like, we gotta consider like the travel that goes into all of this. And I do think that all roads lead to Winterfell for Lady Stoneheart, and Baelish could very well be at Winterfell by the time she is. So,
I agree. Yeah, it's gonna be totally different, because she has, I think, a good bit of. I don't know that she'll make it through the Winds of Winter, but I think she's going to have something, you know, of significance to do.
Yeah.
Is she going to meet Melisandre? That's where you get into all the things with Winds of Winter. And you can even see some of those threads here in this chapter too. Like, as we know, things that tie into Lady Stoneheart, there's a lot of them in these chapters with Catelyn. But, you know, like, there's one where it talks about, like, right here, we all want Lord. This is in like the last page, or at least I'm looking at it on Kindle, so it might be the second to last page in the book. We all want Lord Walder to die happy. Catelyn was growing less and less comfortable with this arrangement. My brother has just lost his own father. He needs time to mourn. Like, we all want Lord Walder to die happy. Well, it seems likely that Arya is still going to be the one to kill Walder Frey, but...
Or maybe it's Lady Stoneheart.
Right. In order for that to happen, Arya still has to come back. And I think
That's right.
There's still quite a bit of story to tell before Arya comes back to Westeros.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think Catelyn having something to do with the Freys obviously makes sense. Great revenge tale. There's supposedly a second Red Wedding. A lot of people say a second Red Wedding because at the end of one of the books, I think it might be Feast for Crows, we hear about a Frey wedding that's about to happen. And this is going to put like you know, the spotlight on this certain frame marriage is going to elevate them because the Lannisters are giving them their due. It's like a Lannister cousin. I'm sorry, folks. Right. I don't have the details in my head right now, but all signs point to it being hijacked and becoming a red wedding. And a lot of people think that Lady Stoneheart will be the one to lead that, with Tom Sevenstrings being in River Run. And then you hear about them sending out like a carriage or something and it being destroyed. Like they're losing people on the roads. Like it's very much implied that we're going to have some sort of Stoneheart revenge piece in the Winds of Winter. Catelyn most likely also, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think she'll end up in the Winterfell crypts with Ned's bones at some point. Yeah. The opening lines of this chapter are, "Let the kings of winter have their cold crypt under the earth," Catelyn thought. "The Tullys drew their strength from the river, and it was to the river they returned when their lives had run their course." Her life ran its course and she was in a river, and now she has been resurrected, which is a very Stark-esque thing. So the other side of her is the Stark side, and she has not fulfilled that for her afterlife promise. I think that she could very well end up in the crypts as her final resting place.
Yeah. Oh, who is actually, I should look. I'm going to look this up real quick because I always forget. Who is her? Do we know who her mother is? Because I think we always look at her as a Tully and a Stark, but that she really marries into the Starks.
Yeah, I do not remember.
It might not even be stated.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I just know that the Tully piece of her is
for sure
definitely the more, especially once Ned dies, I think she starts to think about herself being a Tully more. You know, one thing I really liked about the chapter, Matt?
Her mother is a Wendt.
A Wendt? I thought it said a wench at first. I was like, whoa, no, whoa, whoa.
From House Wendt.
House Wendt.
Yes.
J.G. Wentworth.
The Lords of Harrenhal.
Cursed. They're cursed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. All of it leads back to Harrenhal. You know, one thing I like about this chapter, Matt, is when Rob talks about how he never got to see his grandfather much, and it really solidifies how far away things are in this world and how separated everything is. And traveling is not a convenience in the least. And because you look at it, you go, oh, River Run, Winterfell, it's like a day trip. You know, no. It's like months. It's by a month worth trip, right? So like the fact that he's never really talked to his grandfather, like, but a couple times is crazy in many ways. So I kind of like that the fact that this chapter re-solidifies. It's like, remember, these places are very spread out. Travel is not a convenience. And this is why, you know, some people thought Ned Stark was Robert Baratheon when he sat on the Iron Throne in book one, because they've never seen the king. They're coming into King's Landing first. They don't know what Robert Burt looks like. Like, they have no idea.
Yeah.
Very
something,
real.
Something else I want to point out about this chapter. You know who is not in this chapter?
Ghost?
Ghost? That's John's
diary. Oh, I'm sorry.
Grey Wind.
Grey Wind, sorry.
Yes, Grey Wind is not this. Yeah, you're fine. Grey Wind is not in this chapter. A lot of bad decisions. Keep the wolves close. Wolves go away. Bad things happen. Just something I always like to point out whenever I can remember it, the tracking of the dire wolves. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you said, there's a lot in here. So this chapter opens up, obviously, and they're dealing with Hoster Tully's death. I think the show does a great job of showing this scene. If you're somebody who's like, I just want to go watch that scene, it's pretty funny. It's one of the more comedic moments in Game of Thrones, where he keeps missing, and Edmure ends up being sort of comedic relief in the show. And then even I actually thought he had, if anybody remembered who he was in the final scene, that was actually one of the good moments in season 8, was when they're just mm-hmm. not when they're deciding to just be like, well, who just wants to stand up and be king, but the fact that Edmure offers himself and Sansa tells him, you know, sit down, you know.
Yeah, Edmure is one of my favorite side characters, and I thought it was pretty funny in the book as well, by the way. Like, and the fact that they're like, well, Hoster actually missed his first arrow at another funeral, and then Catelyn's like, well, he hit the second one though. It's like, yeah, dude, like, Catelyn, you don't have to say that. Yeah. Edmure is the man. I love the Tullys, man. So the family dynamic is bizarre,
and I mean, that's a character I think is also going to have a bigger role in Winds of Winter. And
yes, there's going to be some major Tully revenge coming.
Yeah. Okay. So some other cool things. There's just a lot of really good lines in here.
Yes.
As well, House Frey might have abandoned the kings in the north, but the Lord of the Crossing remained the most powerful of Riverrun's bannermen, and Lothar was here in his stead. The Seven launched. Lord Hoster from their waiter stair, waiting down the steps as the portcullis was winched upward. Lothar Frey, a soft-bodied, portly man, was breathing heavy as they shoved the boat into the current. Jason Malister and Titus Blackwood at the prow stood chest deep in the river to guide it on its way. Catelyn watched from the battlements, waiting and watching as she had waited and watched so many times before. Beneath her, the swift, wild tumblestone plunged like a spear onto the side of the board. Of the broad Red Fork, excuse me. Its blue-white current churning in the muddied red-brown flow of the greater river. A morning mist hung over the water, a thin as gossamer at the wisps of memory. Bran and Rickon will be waiting for him, Catelyn thought sadly, as once I used to wait.
I like the morning mist, by the way, because that's kind of a double meaning. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in mourning, but it's also the morning. I like that. George's descriptions are always they're so succinct and so beautiful, even whenever they're like ugly, you know.
Yeah, later after you get past you know, Edmure just missing a bunch, you know,
or Edmure.
Yeah, I know. Then suddenly, as hope, they saw the red bloom flower. The sails took fire, and the fog, geez, if I can speak today, glowed pink and orange. For a moment, Catelyn saw the outline of the boat clearly, wreathed in leaping flames. Watch for me, little cat, she could hear him whisper.
Yeah, man. That kind of heartbreaking, isn't it? Also, remember, she lies to Edmure about the final words. Like, yeah, he mentioned you right at the end, but instead he was saying Tansy, which I've been going on about for our last few episodes, about how Tansy is just dropped in multiple ways and multiple uses, and then we kind of put it together by the end of this book. But yeah, like I said, I felt the melancholy and the grieving in this chapter. And I think that's one of the reasons why this story works so well, is like, we go through a lot of traumatic experiences through our protagonist's eyes, you know, in different points of view. And George is able to relay that to us in like a really real and human way that doesn't feel like myth or lore, or, you know what I'm talking about? Like, it doesn't feel as removed as something like Greek mythology or some of Tolkien's stuff. To me, this hits like right at the human element of the story, which is why a lot of people describe A Song of Ice and Fire as feeling more realistic. I always think that's funny because it's, you know, it's somewhat realistic, but it's still a fantasy story, right? But the realism comes within the emotion. So I think it just feels very intimate. And Catelyn's, like I said, Catelyn's inner thoughts about all this stuff and death and her family and position it's in, I think is really compelling.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to pull up this other line here, too. So just a little bit further down here. So Lord Hoster looked as noble as a king, my lady, murmured Jane. What would that I have been given the chance to know him? And I to know him better, added Rob, like you said earlier. He would have wished that, too, said Catelyn. There were too many leagues between Riverrun and Winterfell, and too many mountains and rivers and armies between Riverrun and the Eyrie, it would seem. I think also just kind of like a nod to the mountain, which is just a cool little George writing there.
Yeah.
Lyza had made no reply to her letter, and from King's Landing came only silence as well. By now, she had hoped that Brienne and Sir Cleos would have reached the city with their captive. It might even be that Brienne was on her way back, and the girls with her. Sir Cleos swore he would make the imp send a raven once the trade was made. He swore it. Ravens did not always win, though. Just a cool little line there. I do like.
And neither do the Baltimore Ravens, am I right? No, I don't know. I just want to throw in.
Aren't they like 2-2, I think? Or they're okay this year, yeah.
They can go to hell. All right.
Whoa, Jimmy's a Browns fan. I'm a Steelers fan. I'm wearing my Steelers shirt, but
rough year.
I kind of like the Ravens. I respect them. As a Steelers fan, I respect the Ravens. They're like our real, I mean, the Browns are supposed to be our rival, but I mean, it's like,
I mean, you gotta be the Ravens. You gotta win every now and then to be a rival. Right. Yeah. Ravens lose though. Sometimes the Ravens lose. Sometimes the messages don't get to where they're going. And that is a huge piece of A Song of Ice and Fire, and a lot of the troubles that come around. A different version of the miscommunication trope, which I really like.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I like that little line about the mountains and stuff like that. And he swore ravens did not always win, though. So like that's just an interesting line, because, you know, it's just talking about like that he specifically chooses win, right? I mean, that's just such a, because there's nothing really in there about winning. It's just, oh, they make the trade and we get them back, though. So it says ravens did not always win. Just an interesting line.
Yeah, I part of me, it was like, I forgot that Catelyn like pleads with Rob in that private conversation to bend the knee.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought back about it and I'm like, I don't even know if they would have accepted the bending of the knee at this point.
Because, There's no point to it.
Yeah, like they know that they're going to do the red wet. Like they have the final pieces of this puzzle.
I don't think there's anything he can do at this point.
But they don't even know. Like they think that it's still like a 50-50 and they got to go back, but they're going to come. And they have won a lot of battles, by the way. And they're not aware of where Jaime is and where Arya actually is. So like in their mind, they still have like some sort of leverage, but I think
it's gone at this point. It's over because
they don't know it.
The only thing they could do at this point is stay at Riverrun
and go to Essos, I guess, because they don't know that the Boltons have already made the deal and the Freys have made the deal. Like the Red Wedding is in writing at this point. Like we've been hearing about it through whispers. If you know, on a reread, you see all the way back in Clash of Kings. So it's a wrap. And it's just, I was thinking about it from the perspective of the Starks. And I was like, yeah, you know, Catelyn might've been right at this point. Like she might've been right. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, nah, it wouldn't have mattered at all. They would have just lost their honor.
Winterfell's gone. They can't go north through the Freys, and the South is screwed too. If you try to do it, they're screwed. I mean,
it's checkmate. They're still playing their game, not realizing it. But you know what's really interesting about this, or maybe the main point of this, is that Ned Stark decided to concede and bend the knee and ruin his honor in his last moments and say he committed treason. And Joffrey went against that and ruined him, right? And everyone said Joffrey's an exceptional monster and not a Lannister. He's the exception, right? Like, he's so evil, he's the exception. Except Tywin would have done the exact same thing in this moment, right?
Yeah.
If he bent the knee, Rob would have thought he was doing a noble thing, a humble thing, and then he would have been killed anyways. So it's not Joffrey being extra evil. That's just the way it is in King's Landing and with the Lannisters. So that's kind of an interesting parallel to draw between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. Then I think this, even though it's not the last line of the chapter, I think it's just sort of like a good line here, because it sort of just describes this whole chapter as things. It's like, okay, it's getting somber, and then things just get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
So the Ironmen. Sir Roger Cressel said Catelyn numbly, the dear, brave, loyal old soul. She could almost see him tugging on his fierce white whiskers. What of our other people? The Ironmen put them to the sword, I fear. Wordless with rage, Rob slammed a fist down on the table and turned his face away so that the Freys would not see his tears. But his mother saw them. The world grows a little darker every day.
Yeah, and it's like, how much more can we take is her mindset? And I totally understand, because like I said, you can now see on a reread, of course, things were slipping far, you know, every decision has put them further and further back. And it's not all their own faults. Like, a lot of people paint the Starks as just idiots or like bumbling morons that all they do is mess up. But like, it also was just straight treachery from Theon.
Yeah.
And the Boltons being immoral and not abiding by what they thought was the honor code, which they had no reason not to believe them at this point. So like, it's not all the Starks' own doing. They didn't help themselves in many ways. But it also comes down to people just doing some really terrible shit to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if Rob had married a Frey and the Boltons are still going to betray them, like, what does that get them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Winterfell still gets raised. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you've strengthened your alliance in the Riverlands, but that doesn't really do a ton for you, because Winterfell getting taken by the Boltons. It is like, now nobody's going to trust you or believe you or anything. I mean, you're screwed.
Yeah.
That was the worst decision was letting Theon go.
Yes. Yes. Theon Greyjoy was not a good idea.
Of any of the decisions, that's the worst one. Because if Theon doesn't go, yeah, like the Red Wedding can still happen. You don't know that's going to happen. But I mean, that's the thing that causes them to say, we need to try and go back. So they go, okay, now let's make amends with the Freys. Like, you could have just not made amends with the Freys and be like, well, I'm the king of the North and I'm going to be the king of the Riverlands, so you're going to have to deal with it. And you could just sort of tell the Freys off, but it's the decision to be like, we need to head back to Winterfell now.
Mm-hmm.
Means we're going to have to cross through the twins in order to get back and not, you know, potentially go some other way. But Yeah, it all, I think it all kind of hinged on the one thing, the letting Theon go, because that's what screwed it all up.
Yeah, it's also hard to trace the one thing, because we could also go back all the way to,
you could make an argument and say, well, maybe if she should, they never should have let Jaime go.
They should. Well, that's what I was about to bring up. I said maybe that's actually the biggest thing, because that was the only piece of leverage they ever had. Like,
yeah,
capture wise. I mean, they had Tyrion too. That was out of their hands. It was a battle that they lost or whatever. There's a lot. I mean, you could say Ned accepting to be Hand of the King, you know, but then we wouldn't have this really cool story to talk about. So I'm right. Glad that they messed up.
right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'll read the last little bit here too. So this is after they've said, okay, you're going to have to marry Edmure. You're going to have to marry a Frey. I had a so the Blackfish said, I am the last man in the Seven Kingdoms to tell anyone they must wed, nephew. Nonetheless, you did say something of making amends for your battle of the fords.
Mm-hmm.
I had in mind a different sort of amends. Single combat with the Kingslayer, 7 years of penance as a begging brother, swimming in the sunset sea with my legs tied. When he saw that no one was smiling, Edmure threw up his hands. The others take you all. Very well. I'll wed the wench as amends.
Yeah, a little bit of comedic relief at the end here. But I also think it's funny that they're harping on Edmure for his fumble, which he did, by the way. He fumbled, but they also didn't clue him in earlier. And that's why he messed up, because he didn't have all the information. So they should have trusted him more. So I've always had a little bit of a soft spot for Edmure in this whole situation. Not to mention that everyone just kind of tiptoes around the fact that Rob has made a massive strategic error by going against his oaths of wedding a Frey. So like, I feel like it's very unfair that he's being put in this situation. And then he's going to make
Rob's the one who messed up.
Yeah. And then whenever they finally do this wedding, with him trying to do what's right for his family and for the war, it's going to be Rob's mistake ultimately that gets all their heads lopped off. So it's like, I don't know. Edmure is abused, and he should have been clued in earlier, but he's also kind of a boob and has anger problems. So I don't know. It's tough. It's really tough. When you don't trust the people underneath you to make decisions to lead people, bad things happen. And they didn't trust Edmure. He fumbled, and everything has just cascaded from there.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Woo. All right. Hey, excellent chapter. And you know, it's a big one because like we said, it ties into a lot of Lady Stoneheart and all of these things. What are we into next time? Oh, we'll be into Davos.
Yeah,
this is the Davos prison chapter. So that's gonna be, I think it's a Melisandre action going on there. So
yeah.
All right. Well, guys, hey, as we said, Jimmy and I did a Patreon episode the other day, which should be up as well by the time you guys are listening to this, doing a big breakdown of House of the Dragon with that new news of what we think season 3 and season 4 will look like. So with that, we want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing A Storm of Swords, Chapter 36, Davos 4.
And if you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com or bendtheneepodcast.com.
We'll see you next time. And remember that winter is coming.